Well, welcome. You're the tough ones, the survivors, that your brains are not quite full. So our evening speaker this evening, I'm sure, will finish the job off. We're very happy to have Woody Tash with us at this year's conference. He's in the swamp that is the world's banking and economic systems and markets. He is a true bright light. His book, Slow Money, has been hailed by reviewers and critics everywhere as visionary and the message that we need to hear. He's going to talk to us today about the need for investing as if food and farming and land and the permanent things that our society needs really matter. Woody's background is both been nonprofits and in the investment world. He's with the directors, the investor circle that he's involved with, they've placed over $130 million in startup ventures. He's a man who knows of which he speaks. I'll let him tell his own story. Please welcome Woody Tash.
No one ever said I know wherever I speak before, so I don't know. I don't know what to make of that. But thanks for sticking around on a rainy Saturday night. I know we're all worried about getting out of here tomorrow, so we'll all see each other in the lobby, I guess, or at the airport or wherever we're going to be. So I was trying to think how to use the time, given that it's the end of the conference, and I know we're all tired. I mean, I've talked to a whole bunch of you. I just got here last night, and so I've talked to a whole bunch of you a lot today. We've had great conversations. How are we doing on the feedback? We need to turn it down a little. All right. I think that's no. I think we're good. So anyhow, so I was thinking about I dredged up a 2-minute video, courtesy of YouTube. It's amazing that what you can find nowadays. And this 2-minute video, we actually showed. We had an event at Shelburne Farms, Vermont, in June. That I'll talk about when I tell you what we're doing. What I'm going to do tonight is I'm going to tell you about the vision of Slow Money, which arose from the book, which I wrote a couple of years ago and just started a big conversation that we are trying to keep up with. And then I'm going to tell you what we're actually doing, what's actually happening on the ground right now, and then have time for a conversation. But the night before our event in Shelburne, I was having dinner with a few friends, and we started talking, and this clip came up in our conversation, and just so it won't seem totally random, I guess I'm going to spoil a little bit. It's how many people have ever saw the movie Network? How many people over the age of 79 saw the movie Network? No, just kidding. So the movie Network is from 1976. I'll bet you all of you who saw it haven't seen it in a long time, so it'll be fun. There's a 2-minute clip. And the reason I picked this 2-minute clip is, it's not I'm mad as hell and I'm not going to take it anymore. It's not that clip. That's the really iconic one. But you'll see what this is. It popped into my head when I was actually working on the book, this actual clip. And, you know, courtesy of Google and YouTube, you can go and find anything. And I said, did I remember that right? Did he really say blah, blah, blah? So this is in the spirit of setting us up to have a big discussion about money and nature. All right? So let's run this clip.
You have meddled with the primal forces of nature, Mr. Beale, and I won't have it! Is that clear? You think you merely stopped a business deal? That is not the case. The Arabs have taken billions of dollars out of this country, and now they must put it back! It is ebb and flow, tidal gravity, it is ecological balance. You are an old man who thinks in terms of nations and peoples. There are no nations. There are no peoples. There are no Russians. There are no Arabs. There are no third worlds. There is no West. There is only one holistic system of systems. One vast and immane, interwoven, interacting, multivariate, multinational dominion of dollars. Petrodollars, electrodollars, multidollars, Reichmarks, rims, rubles, pounds, and shekels. It is the international system of currency which determines
the totality of life on this planet. That is the natural order of things today. That is the atomic and subatomic and galactic structure of things today. And you have meddled with the primal forces of nature. And you will atone. Am I getting through to you, Mr. Beale?
Any questions? That's it. That's the talk. They did it way better than I could do it. All right. So I don't know how that seemed to people who had never seen it, didn't know what the context was or anything. The context was a major multinational conglomerate taking over a TV station. Was the guy, and Beale, the old man, was someone who worked for the TV station and started speaking out against the merger and blah, blah, blah. But what a prescient movie. 1976. So since I did show that, I would say there's maybe a little subtext to the way I talk about this, because I'm going to bring up E.F. Schumacher a lot, and Small is Beautiful. So there's another question. How many people have read Small is Beautiful? This is serious stuff. How many people have read Small is Beautiful? So it's interesting. Not that many, really, out of a crowd that you would think would be pretty heavy, self-selected. I mean, I'll just say this. We're all here because of people like E.F. Schumacher thought what he thought and said what he said 40 years ago. So he wrote a book called Small is Beautiful. I think it came out around 1976. I'm not sure exactly which year. It was right in the same time frame. And so, you know, you could argue, if you wanted to have a kind of an historical argument, that there was a bunch of stuff that happened in the late 60s and through the mid-70s that were like seeds that took 40 years to sprout, and now they're starting to sprout. You could actually, I guess I'm going to argue that. You know, the subtitle of my book, Investing as if Food, Farms, and Fertility Mattered, actually is a direct ripoff or homage to Schumacher. The subtitle of his book, Small is Beautiful, is Economics as if People Mattered. So any student of Schumacher knows that I was just completely, you know, tipping my cap, if you want to be respectful, if that's what I thought I was doing, not ripping it off. So, and there's a lot of Schumacher in the book directly, and I have one Schumacher quote in my PowerPoint. So let's say, seminal thinking and a bit of activism that happened in the 70s, I think we would all say didn't really take, right? It kind of started, and then it kind of didn't know what to do. And what happened?
It fizzled.
That's the technical. That's a technical term that I'm not familiar with. But yes. So I think you remember 7-Up used to be the Uncola. It was fizzling too. I don't know. Nothing came out of the 70s. I don't know what happened. So. But actually, when we go through this talk, and I go through all this stuff, and I was talking to someone, and she said, it's not pie in the sky, is it? And it isn't pie in the sky, what we're doing. But it is a big turning of an historic little wheel here. And, you know, we have another shot at this. We meeting, like, the species, if you want to be that big. And then say we as, let's say, Americans, if you want to put us in a certain place, or we as people who are promoting organics or small-scale agriculture or local economies. We have another shot at it. A question that comes up often is, why do we think it might happen this time when it didn't happen the last time? And of course, we don't really know the answer to that one. But I think there are some reasons to think it might. The reasons to think it might are things like climate change. I mean, it was only five. By the way, I haven't even started my talk yet. This is just, I'm just rambling at the beginning. Just so, Saturday night. You're lucky I didn't tell you a joke. That might happen, though, still. Could happen. Because there's actually jokes in this book. This book is not a typical book about finance. It's a book that weaves together biology, humor, culture, history. I will read a page or two from it just to give you a flavor of it. Because this time that the wheel's coming around, we do have a shot at something important. The odds are obviously stacked against us, meaning the forces moving in the other direction are so strong and so entrenched that even the best intentioned, it's not a matter of greed, I don't think, it's not a matter of evil, it's just a matter of that you just have this embedded momentum of this thing that's happening called consumerism and industrialization and globalization that isn't just going to stop. But the reason I think it's okay to believe that we are going to make a difference this time is because of things like climate change. Now, it was only 5 years ago, I think. When did Inconvenient Truth come out? something like 5 years, whatever it was. Al Gore, up until that point, whatever you think of him now, he's not one of my favorite people or anything, but whatever you think of him now, he was just ridiculed as basically a lunatic up until about 5 years ago. And then suddenly, because of that movie, basically the work that was done around Inconvenient Truth and the activism that supported it, suddenly there was a Nobel Prize, and he was a presidential candidate, or whichever order that all that thing happened. I think got the order out of order there a little bit. But he suddenly he actually did catalyze something. And the way I would say what he catalyzed is, he obviously didn't give us any solutions, like everything didn't change. But right now, there is not an educated person on this planet who does not have an opinion about climate change. You have to have an opinion about climate change. Even if you don't think it's man-made, you have to have an opinion about it. You have to have thought about it. You have to listen to everybody arguing about it. If I were giving one of the sort of punchlines about what I've learned in the couple of years of talking about slow money, I would say it's acting on your beliefs, acting with money on your beliefs. So if you believe that climate change is real, or you believe that it's probable, or you believe that it's possible, I would actually argue in all those cases, you have to start doing something different with at least some of your money. Otherwise, you're just kind of giving yourself over to these impersonal forces. It's funny, I was upstairs today because I was just trying to think of how to do tonight a little differently, and I already am. But that's a good thing. That's a good thing. So I put a quote in here from RFK. You're going to see a quote in a minute from Robert F. Kennedy from a couple of months before he was shot. And there's another quote that I actually used once, but I've never used this quote before. It came up in conversation the other day. And his brother, JFK, a few months before he was shot, I mean, it's pretty crazy. By the way, this is all roughly the same time frame, late 60s and 70s. Kind of, there's something, it means something. I don't know what it means. And JFK gave a speech at graduation at American University. It was a fairly famous speech, but it's kind of gotten lost in history. And it was an anti-Cold War speech. It was a very strong pacifist speech about reversing nuclear proliferation and detente with the Russians, which at that time was complete political heresy. You're talking about early 60s when he was speaking, and he was talking about detente with Russia, how Russia was not our enemy. The enemy was nuclear proliferation and a belief that arms could solve, political problems. And actually, a book came out a couple of years ago, recently, saying that that speech was one of the reasons he was killed. It's pretty crazy, everyone's always trying to come up with the reason. But, so where am I trying to go with this? This is a big conversation. And this time around, it might be different because climate change is in our consciousness and why we're all here. The proactive thing, actually, people are beginning to figure out that local, smaller scale, fresh, healthy, sensible, tangible things, that's what we need. So whether it's local economies or alternative currency or organics, this is a real thing. It's really happening. So the woman who was asked me about pie in the sky, I know she's in here somewhere. I was talking to her before. She said, are you hopeful? Do you think there's like a trend that more people are going to be able to make a living at farming, and it seems so hopeless and it seems so difficult? And of course, it's still really hard, but there are seriously positive data points. They're very small. I'm not here to try to sell them to you. You guys know them all better than I do anyway. But if you look at the CSAs and farmers markets and the number of small farms under 49 acres, all these things are actually trending in a very positive direction, but they're coming off of like a tiny base, right? The pendulum is still way over here. Now, there's another theme before I actually start giving you my talk, which is, you've already figured it out though, it's not just about food, it's about money and the economy and some really big things. When you put the word slow together with money, the reason this thing has, I'm not saying we've like taken off yet, but it seems like we're taking off, is because when you put the word slow together with money, it's not just about slow food anymore. It's about where your money is going. You say, where does our food come from? We all are part of the movement of asking, because consumers and all of us are asking, where does our food come from? How's it produced, et cetera? You add the question, where does our money go? Where's our money going? To that question of where does our food come from? And it just explodes the whole conversation into a big conversation about structural economic issues. What kind of economy do we want? Where's our money? Do you care if your money is going to China? We know that food's coming from China. How many people think about how much of your dollars are going up smokestacks in China right now? I guarantee you, if we could figure it out, if we sat here and everyone put their portfolios on the table, and we went, probably, I'll be conservative, 33% of everybody's investment portfolio is going up smokestacks in China. Because that's where, if you put your money in the stock market, it is invested in China. What do you think it kept us out of a depression? Yeah, the stimulus. I mean, there was something like $30 trillion worth of global money poured in stimulus. It wasn't just the trillions or so that we did in the United States. China, because it's not a democracy, they don't mess around. You know, when they put stimulus money to work, they just put it to work. They don't ask a lot of questions. It's not a lot of debate like there isn't. At least we have debate. As horrible as our debate is, at least we get to have it. We're gonna have really good debate after I talk in here. So anyhow, let's see. What else do I want to say before? I think what I'm going to do is I'm going to read the opening page of the book just to support my argument that this is a big discussion. Then I'm going to go through a PowerPoint, and then we'll talk some more. And I did queue up again because it was Saturday night, and I was trying to think of making it a little more fun. I do have 6 minutes more of really cool video at the end if we want to do that, and maybe we'll have time. Yeah, because you guys have been talking a lot, and I'm talking some more. So, all right, the opening of the book. Mr. Gandhi, a reporter said during Gandhi's 1930 visit to England, what do you think of Western civilization? I think it would be a very good idea, he replied. That's a very true story, very famous moment in his life. I did not want to start this book with a reference to Gandhi. I really and truly did not. Having been in and around the sustainability movement for a few decades now, I've heard enough Margaret Mead and Gandhi and Einstein quotes to last several lifetimes. But if Tom Robbins can start a novel with a reference to a beat, then anything goes. How many know that reference? Come on, there's going to be some people. You don't count, Jim. I'm not counting you. Do you know which one it is?
I can't remember it.
Okay, so the opening line of Jitterbug Perfume, for those of you, the few of you who have not read it, is the beet is the most intense of vegetables. What a great opening line for a novel. Not too many novelists could pull off the novel that came after that line. I am making light because the subjects at hand are ponderous, because I have an inveterate skepticism when it comes to the lifeless and humorless prognostications of the experts, and because I have had it up to here with the opaque, impersonal, deathly dull dismalness of the dismal science of economics. In our search for answers to the great questions of our day, we would be well served to listen less to economists and more to philosophers, poets, ecologists, entrepreneurs, and farmers. To see what might lie beyond the era of economics, we must look above the top line and below the bottom line. I mean this almost literally. Above the top line is the region of the meta, what E.F. Schumacher called meta-economics. Below the bottom line is the territory of the sub, as in subterranean. Not in the sense of journeying to the center of the earth or anything that science fictional, but something equally fantastic and preposterously too non-commodifiably invisible to the modern and postmodern mind, the rich, symbiotically phenomenal, mysteriously fertile life of the soil. A very good idea would be a civilization that did not strip its topsoil, turn it into cheap food and highly processed food products of questionable nutritional value, and put its faith in markets at the expense of places. I'll stop reading in a second. Civilization is a big idea. So is the idea that as soil goes, so goes civilization. So is the idea that as money goes, so goes the soil. We don't need any more big ideas. We need small ideas, beautiful because they lead to a large number of beautiful small actions, the kind alluded to by Wendell Berry. Quote, soil is not usually lost in slabs or heaps of magnificent tonnage. It is lost a little at a time over millions of acres by careless acts of millions of people. It cannot be solved by heroic feats of gigantic technology, but only by millions of small acts and restraints. Unquote. So you get the idea. It's a big conversation. It's a big conversation about the future of everything, really. And so, I mean, if there's one message I would bring to you from my swamp, the swamp of finance and capital markets, it's that what is going on, what we are doing here, groups like this are doing, is not just healing the land, it's healing our culture, healing our society, creating relationships that have a chance to pull us out of this quagmire that we're in. And that sounds kind of far-fetched, but if it's going to happen, it's going to happen because of stuff here. It's not going to happen in politics. It's not going to happen with the Tea Party fighting the so-and-so. It's not going to happen with Wall Street and regulators trying to regulate Wall Street. And it's sure not going to happen in Washington, right? It just isn't. It can't. It's just not. Anybody who thinks that, then you're a hopeless optimist, I guess. I'm a hopeful optimist, and I'm not a hopeless optimist. So, all right. So here comes the PowerPoint. Are we ready? All right. Are we ready? I'm not ready. Where's the... Oh, there it is. Thank you very much. Okay. Does this need any explanation? I don't think so. Okay, this is the JFK quote, the RFK quote, which I'm going to read off my computer. Don't try to read it on the screen. It kind of breaks all the rules to even put it there. But I just, I wasn't sure if I was going to have my computer with me. So just listen. Don't look at it. Just listen. I'm serious. You might even want to close your eyes for this. This is one of the 1968 RFK. We will find neither national purpose nor personal satisfaction in a mere continuation of economic progress in an endless amassing of worldly goods. We cannot measure national spirit by the Dow Jones average, nor national achievement by the gross national product. For the gross national product includes air pollution and ambulances to clear our highways from carnage. It counts special locks for our doors and jails for the people who break them. The gross national product includes the destruction of the redwoods and the death of Lake Superior. It grows with the production of napalm and missiles and nuclear warheads. It includes the broadcasting of television programs which glorify violence to sell goods to our children. And if the gross national product includes all this, there is much that it does not comprehend. It does not allow for the health of our families, the quality of their education, or the joy of their play. It is indifferent to the decency of our factories and the safety of our streets alike. It does not include the beauty of our poetry or the strength of our marriages, the intelligence of our public debate, or the integrity of our public officials. The gross national product measures neither our wit nor our courage, neither our wisdom nor our learning, neither our compassion nor our devotion to our country. It measures everything, in short, except that which makes life worthwhile, and it can tell us everything about America except whether we are proud to be Americans. Can barely read it. I can barely read that. I've never read it in public before. So when I went online today to find it, I also discovered, I'm just going to stick with me for a second. I'm taking advantage of a Saturday night thing here for informality. And I scrolled down. I saw there were a lot of comments. This post had been on this website for a couple of years. It was just randomly. I got to the website, you know, through Google. And I just read some of the comments. There was like a bunch of comments on here that have been on here for a couple of years, and they're really amazing. And it just shows how serious these issues are and how much they really go to like what you believe as a person, what's happening on the planet, and if you really say out loud what you believe. So I'm just going to read a few of the comments because they're amazing. Let me just find one. Just bear with me. I think it'd be worth it. Okay. Here's a comment from someone interesting, whose online name is Urban Gardner. GDP, the total, first he gave a definition. GDP, the total market value of all final goods and services produced in a country in a given year equal to the total consumer investment and government spending plus the value of exports minus the value of imports. So he like gave a formula. Then he said, only if exchanged for dollars. You can transport a child to school via your car, in which case the service produced for your child is not included in GDP, or via a taxi cab or limo service, in which case it is included in GDP. You can wash your family's clothes in the laundry room of your home, in which case it is not included, or you can leave them at the dry cleaners, in which case it is included. You can watch your kids after school, which is not included, or you can hire a babysitter, which is included. You can cook them a meal in the kitchen, not included in the GDP, or you can pay the nanny or the pizza delivery guy or the restaurant to do it instead, included in GDP. Same service performed, different way of counting. I mean, you get the idea. Let me just find one more. Okay, another comment. I sense that we are in a time of great change, perhaps of the same historical magnitude as the fall of Rome and the descent of Europe in the Dark Ages. Listen to this comment. It's pretty amazing. The concomitant rise of the superior power and culture of Islam, the Renaissance, and the drive to throw off the colonial chains of Europe that swept across the Americas from Canada to Argentina in the late 18th and early 19th centuries. The end of the era of unlimited and cheap energy is certainly part of this sea change. How the United States adapts to the new environment will determine its future and its standing in the new world order. A new philosophical framework will be required. Our definition of good and successful will have to change. Over the last 3,000 years, the ascendant philosophies were, in chronological sequence, paganism, Islam, Christianity, and enlightenment rationality. Almost done. This is pretty heavy. It got pretty heavy here. The new age will require a new philosophy, and the people that is the most creative at crafting this new philosophy will dominate tomorrow's world, both from a power and cultural perspective. All right, you got the idea. This is a big discussion. Good, now I'm back to that. Okay. just going to keep going. This is actually a poem. I wrote it. That's how I know that it's a poem. Also, you'll notice that the second and fourth lines do rhyme. But it's kind of abstract, and I think you'll get the idea. This is my version of the big thing in a few words. Circulation versus percolation, monoculture versus diversity, transaction versus relationship, profitability versus fertility. And if you just think about it for a second, you will discern that the four values, if you will, on the left, circulation, monoculture, transaction, and profitability, that's the world we're living in right now. That's capital markets that are defining, you know, everything about modern life. And the value system that we're trying to now optimize for and move towards is more about percolation, diversity, relationship, and fertility. So I won't belabor that point so that we can get through the PowerPoint. Okay, I'm remembering now that, don't look at that yet. And also, it's not a real, the graphics aren't good, I'm going to have to read it for you. I realize these first couple of slides I put in and said, we had the pig, the opening slide of the pig, and I didn't really say anything about it. That's there because besides the fact that it's a Nyman Ranch hog and it's outside and all those other good things, and it's cute. It was cute, wasn't it? It was cute. I thought it was cute. Is that I often am speaking in front of investor groups, and it's there to say we have to stare the pig in the face, and the pig is us, you know, and then you can get into capitalist pig and a lot of other things, but that are both serious and playful. But these first slides were really meant to be when different people stare at the pig in the face, what do they come up with? RFK, when he stared the pig in the face, came up with that amazing, beyond amazing articulation. This is what one of the things I come up with when I do it. And here's what, and so what I'm imagining is when the following New Yorker cartoon stared at the pig in the face, this is what he or she came up with. Now, it's a copy, so it's a really bad copy, but it shows a bunch of middle-aged sort of white businessmen in traditional business attire. One of them is pointing off into the distance, and they're all looking, and it says, corporate leaders gather in a field outside Darien, Connecticut, where one of them claims to have seen the invisible hand of the marketplace. If you were investors, you would really be laughing hard now. This is and by the way, as crazy as it is, this cartoon is 30 or 40 years old. It wasn't picked for that reason, but it happened to come from New Yorker around the same period of time. And I guarantee you, when this cartoon was put in the New Yorker, there was never any thought that there was a shred of actual wisdom, you know, that it would actually mean as much as it means now. I mean, the invisible hand of the market, which is Adam Smith and kind of the myth of, let's say, not the myth, the effective story of mercantilism and global commerce that really has fueled the economic growth that has raised standards of living and created 1,500 billionaires and all these things. There's a lot of things that have happened because of the invisible hand of the marketplace. They're not all bad by any means. It's a question of now being at a place where doing the same thing over and over again becomes counterproductive, right? So that couldn't have been really known 40 years ago when that cartoon was in there. So all of these, and by the way, that last little bit I said to me is pretty important, and maybe you all get it already. We could talk about it later if you want. It's about like not being against Walmart or not being against Stonyfield because it's too big. Or not just picking some enemy and being against them, not even about being just being against everybody in Goldman Sachs or being against everybody in Washington. Because it's not, if we do that, we'll never get anywhere. It's about focusing on what it is we want to create and just starting to do it from the ground up. And that's what Wendell Berry's, you know, I like to refer to as millions of small acts of care and restraint. I adapted his phrase a little bit. But that's what we're all doing. We're just doing the millions of small things that we need to do to build the new thing and not to kind of pick enemies and blame everything on them. This Mother Jones came out about a year ago. And again, it's just another way of saying this is about more than just food, because if you read the bottom, it says, want to fix the country, fix food. So food is just an entry point. Maybe it's the best entry point, I think it is, to health and water and climate change and local economies and bringing our money back from cyberspace where it's doing all kinds of crazy shit that we don't understand, which is, to me, as destructive as anything that has ever been done. You know, whatever Warren Buffett, what did he say about a derivative? He said they were weapons of money destruction, I think he called them. All right? I mean, we could riff on that all night, or I could. I hope you can, too. Because to me, there's nothing more alienating or destructive to a culture than all of your resources are zooming around in the hands of people you don't know doing things you don't understand. How can that possibly be a good thing? All right, but we all buy into it. You know, if you were talking to a 5-year-old And you said you have two choices when you grow up, the kind of world you're going to get. One world is you're going to go do things that you don't like just so you can make money, so you can save it, and then when you retire, you'll have enough money to live on. And the other world is you're only going to do things you like, and money you make, you're only going to give it to people you know to do things that make you happy. You know, I mean, so it's pathetic. We are so far down the first one. We are so far as a culture that we've ceded all of the responsibility for our money to the so-called experts. And because the world seems so complicated, that sort of seems rational. It's like, oh my God, I can't like figure that shit out for myself. So you give it to people, and then they give it to some other people, and they give it to some other people, and we're getting what we paid for. So this is about starting to say, I don't want to do that anymore. But that's a little scary too, because then it's like, what the hell do we do? No one was trained to do this other thing called like a CSA. What the hell is that? Now, luckily, we have some examples that are so obviously good that it's easy to talk about. That's one. But okay, let me keep going. So the point of this one is it's not just about food. It's about all these structural problems that come out from food into the economy as a whole. Now I'm going to prove the point. This Economist magazine was from about the same time, a year ago this summer. Now, so we've shifted the conversation. Not foodies, right? RFK isn't a foodie either, obviously. So it's not just about food. These are the leading financiers on the planet. Let's say this is a proxy for them. It's one of the magazines that everybody reads. And if you can't see it in the back, it says Modern Economic Theory on the textbook, and it's melting. Meaning, oh my God, all the stuff that we were taught isn't really... Okay, so now why is this article here? I have a story to tell you, and this does relate directly to slow money. I'd been using this slide for about 6 months after it came out in my talks, and sometimes I would explain the background to it, sometimes I wouldn't, depending on how financial the crowd is. So the background to this is that a man named Jeremy Grantham, who's one of the planet's leading money managers, he manages many billions of dollars, his firm is called Grantham Mayo. You've all heard of George Soros, and he's kind of the next rung down, I guess you'd say, very well-respected financier. And he wrote in his newsletter, which is followed by thousands of leading investors, that the efficient market hypothesis was no longer valid. Okay, this would be, I don't know what this would be like. It would be like the baseball commissioner saying home runs were no longer legal. I mean, it was just like saying, like one of the basic tenets that every financier has been using, large and small, for the last 100 years, basically, is no longer valid. He said no longer valid, he meant it no longer described market behavior or investor behavior validly. We needed to come up with some new models. This created a huge kerfuffle among, you know, that tier of people. And the reason I'm telling you the story is, I happened to be giving a talk, and it was actually at Bioneers. I'll tell you where it was. It was an unlikely place, the East Coast Bioneers meeting. And I didn't get into any of the details, but a guy comes up to me after the thing and he says, "Hi, I'm Jeremy Grantham." You can't make a story like this up. And turns out his weekend home is down the street from where the Bioneers conference was, and his daughter-in-law was one of the volunteers at the Bioneers conference. So I looked at him and I said, "Really? Come on, you're kidding me." And he said, no, I'm Jeremy Grantham." So I said, "Am I in trouble?" And he said, "No, not at all. I loved your book, and I agree with most of what you're saying." I never actually got to the bottom of the things he didn't agree with. But we talked for 15 minutes. There were a bunch of people around. And he said, Thomas Malthus was right. He just had the arithmetic wrong. Now, this is a whole other discussion, because it is very, you can see from where we're going in this discussion, the first thing, you open your mouth on this, and the first thing you get called is a Malthusian or a neo-Malthusian or a Luddite or whatever, especially in financial circles. I'm just telling you, I mean, you can't get past the first three sentences and not be called a Malthusian or a Luddite. And again, I would say in this crowd, I don't think we have to get into it too much, but in financial circles, it's a hell of an argument. And Jeremy Grantham may be the only leading world financier right now, who's managing many, many billions of dollars and is widely respected, who believes that unlimited economic growth is not possible, and who says it in public. And by the way, that's a Schumacher. I think I'm going to come to a Schumacher quote in a second, so I'll come back to Schumacher in a second on that point. So the point of this is, it's not just, this is really important. I mean, I don't know if you'll find this heartening. I hope you do. People in finance are talking about this stuff. Not quite to the depth we are, not always in every nuance and everything, but when you have leader, that's on the cover of The Economist. That's not Mother Jones. That's The Economist. Okay, same time frame. A year ago this summer, Time magazine. And I don't know how many of you saw this. You probably can't read the label in there. It says, this hamburger may be hazardous to your health. Why the American food system is bad for our bodies, our economy, and our environment, and what some visionaries are trying to do about it. Time magazine. And if you haven't seen that article, I would commend it to you, not because it's going to tell you anything you don't know, but because it's interesting to know how Time magazine covered this, and it reads like Upton Sinclair's The Jungle. It starts out with, the article starts out with the description of the life of a hog in a hog confinement unit. The first paragraph is this whole long, and I don't have to, you know, go into the details. So this is where, if you see, you know, this hamburger may be hazardous for your health, the American food system, bad for our bodies, our economy and our environment. It's all these things together. It's not just about food. It's about health, economics, et cetera. All right. So the issue of speed, slow money. So what's so slow? What's the point? We could have a whole discussion just about this, but all these are exponential growth curves, if you will, hockey sticks, exponential growth. So CO2 in the atmosphere, population, New York Stock Exchange trading volume. How many people know how many shares a day were traded on the New York Stock Exchange in 1960? Someone guess. I have to wake you up, so I have to get some. Half a million. That's a very radically low guess, but it's in the right general sense. Go another guess. Well, now I gave it. So three million. 3 million. The point is 3 million. No, so it's 3 million shares a day was the average daily trading volume on the New York Stock Exchange in 1960. What is it now? It's no longer just the New York Stock Exchange. It's been, but in that new consolidated entity that we think of as what used to be the New York Stock Exchange, how many shares a day average?
Half a billion a day.
We've got half a billion. We got a 4 billion. Is that a four? Yeah, well, it's 5, 4, 5, 6 billion, whatever. It's billion, many, many billions of shares a day, meaning thousands of fold increase in the trading volume on the New York Stock Exchange during a time when world population went up maybe 2.5 times.